Yes, guys, what's good? You're tuned into Mango Masala, Pi Radio South Asian show. My name's Gerns. I'm here with Halima.
Hey, guys, what's up? What's up?
And Halima, what have you got in front of you? You got a new mic? What's going on?
A new mic is interesting way to put it. A Brooklyn mic might be another way to put it.
Look like you're about to drop the hottest 15 of 2024.
It does.
Or 16. I don't know what
hot
I'm talking
16,
about.
Hot 16, it is a hot 16.
I don't know what I'm talking about. It does look that like wasn't more evident.
It does look like I'm about to drop a hot 16.
Not during Ramadan, Halima.
No.
That's actually one thing I wanted to talk about. We played a song, before we even get into anything, played a song of Zayn's earlier. Zayn Malik, previously One Direction. He's going more for this kind of like, I'm presuming, Halima, that you've never watched One Tree Hill.
You know what? I'm going to be honest, I did.
You did?
I did back in the day when it was on E4. Really? I used to watch it like here and there. Not like, I don't know what I was doing. I think them times I was just watching anything anyhow, like not even consistently as a show. Like, that's I'll just so be funny. Putting it on and watching it. Like,
I find that so funny. But my anchor's obsessed with it. And you know that the main theme song and a singer that does a lot of music for it, Gavin DeGraw. I don't know if you know him, but he's the guy who sings the theme song. And it's very much like that style of music. So it's very interesting. It's because he's
like, Zayn Malik is making what kind of music?
Like, it's kind of like, not country, but you know that kind of like... like slow rock kind of vibe. Like,
I think I kind of like that genre.
Yeah, and he's like very, like, obviously he's done mainly R&B in his solo career so far, so it's very interesting.
That's interesting, but that kind of, I mean, Beyonce's like doing a country album now, so
Lana
that kind of,
well, yeah.
is it, well, I mean, is that what she was doing before anyway, or no?
Nah, she was doing just depressed music.
Right, so. Well, I mean, that kind of music and that adjacent music seems like it's about to have its moment.
2024. But the thing I wanted to discuss in terms of what we just saying before, people are coming for Zayn, basically.
Why?
Because he's obviously, he announced also his upcoming album, which this song is taken from. It's coming out in May, and he's dropped this as the lead single from it. It's called What I Am.
Right.
And a lot of people are coming for him. Obviously, Zayn being the sole South Asian member of One Direction, he has that kind of like following of South Asian young people from that era that are now still following him, and a lot of them are saying like, Zayn, like, why have you chosen to drop this your lead single during Ramadan? But the fact is, he's relaxed, man.
Also,
he said multiple times he's no longer a practicing Muslim.
Yeah,
so
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a bit much, isn't it? It's a bit much. I think, you know what, with Desi people, like, maybe you'll find this as well. With Desi people, we often have, like, entitlement over other Desi people. Mm. And, like, I think it's a thin line between, like, resonance and entitlement. Like, there's a thin line between, like, oh, I resonate with this person, they're from my community, like, I want to support them, I want to uplift them. Like, that bit is good, but the bit where you kind of, like, cross that line and then you start to have, we've spoken about parasocial relationships before on the show, but when you cross that line and you start to have this, like, weird parasocial relationship where there's that level of entitlement and it's, like, because you're Desi, you have to prioritize your Desi, like, audiences and, like, you know, cater to us exclusively. It's a bit ridiculous, guys.
Yeah, I mean, the music's there if you don't want to listen to it.
Don't listen
Ramadan,
to it, innit? Like, yeah. It's not going. It's not like a limited time release where, like, it's disappearing off every single platform after the next 3 weeks. Like, relax, your time will come, innit? Shaitan is fresh home in 3 weeks, guys. Don't worry, your time is coming.
On that note, though, happy Ramadan.
Happy Ramadan.
Yeah. How's it been, first week?
Do you know what, guys? I'm not going to lie. I was really excited for Ramadan this year. Like, I think, have I spoken about it in the show before? No.
What? As in about this year?
This particular year, like, I was really excited. I was like,
I think, yeah, you did.
I need God. Yeah. I need God. Like, I was very excited. Like, God, tell me why, like, on Sunday night, out of nowhere. So Sunday night is the first night where we were praying, like, our nightly prayers and, like, having the, you know, early morning meal, getting ready to fast on Monday. Tell me why Sunday night, out of nowhere, I get so ill. Like, I start burning up. I'm, like, sweating, shaking, all kinds. Like, I still got a cough, guys. Like, you are going to have to bear with that on this show. I'm sorry. So, like, I don't know. I started feeling ill. And, like, I was, like, really disheartened. It was a bit of a bummer because I was, like, really looking forward to it. And then, like, I did still fast. I didn't break my fast. But, like, you just not... I was bedridden. I'm not going to lie, for, like, the first, like, 4 or 5 days. But then I did think, actually, there is also blessing in that. In Islam, we do believe that when you are ill, God is like expiating your sins. He is like basically absolving you, washing away your sins. You're kind of like being forgiven. You're starting fresh. So I was like, do you know what? I see you, God. I see you. Thank you, Allah. Even through the hardship, guys, there is blessing. It's all about perspective.
It is really interesting that obviously this has happened this specific time as well, because of what you were saying, obviously, about how you really needed this to...
I really wanted like a real proper like spiritual alignment this time around. I feel very, I don't know, I feel like the older I get, the more I'm leaning into my religion, the more God conscious I get, the closer I get with God as well, the more I see God like every single day in everything that I do. I've always... Excuse me, guys. Sorry, I'm actually ill. No, I'm not ill anymore, but I just have a cough. Yes. No, I'm not ill. I just have a cough. This always happens, Carlos. Like my friends and family keep asking me, like, Ushi, what is actually wrong with you? Like, you've had this cough like 3 years. Yeah. If you guys listen to the show, I'm always coughing in it.
No, there's my mic. Hello. There's probably some weirdo out there, right? Go back through like the last 4 seasons of Langa Masala and make a compilation of all the times like Halima's coughed or sniffed or something.
Innit? I'm just make it into, always like, a song coughing. Or something. I'm always like... coughing, man. Like, what is this? Like, I got COVID one time, 2020. I mean, I got COVID bare times, but the first time I got COVID, that I was gonna swear that ish never left me. Like, I'm still like, mate.
It is mad though. Like,
my lungs are done out.
I've seen a lot of people talking about like feeling really tired and fatigued.
Yeah, long COVID. I think we still are not aware of like what the consequences of long COVID are going to be on like our generation.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But I'm always coughing. Anyways, as I was saying, I was really looking forward to Ramadan this year. I feel like the older I get, the more I'm like kind of leaning into my faith, the more I'm becoming God conscious, the more I'm seeing God and everything. Especially like for born Muslims, you always kind of have to like go on your own journey of self-discovery to kind of like realign with your faith, because it becomes, where it is like an inheritance, it becomes very easy to kind of have blind faith or to practice without really understanding what is it that I believe in and what does this mean to me and what is my faith to me. So... And Ramadan is just a really heightened time of all of that. You know, Ramadan is just a heightened time of like spirituality and like that closeness with God. And you really feel like, yo, it's me and God is really my ride and die. Like God is really my ride or die. So yeah, like I'm happy. Alhamdulillah, I'm happy to like see another Ramadan. It's obviously an extremely blessed month. Not everyone has been lucky, especially kind of what's been going on in Palestine right now. We say every single year it is an absolute blessing to see Ramadan, and I am blessed to be able to do Ramadan the way that I can, where I am doing it from the comfort of my home and I have a meal to like break my fast with every single day, and I'm comfortable and I can rest and I don't have to do anything that's too strenuous, whereas there are people all over like the Muslim world, in Sudan and Palestine and in Congo and in Yemen and Syria and everywhere, who unfortunately are not having kind of those same experiences and yet they are still fasting. So
that's so much. I never really, like, obviously it's crossed my mind that obviously now, especially for example Palestine, the fact that the ongoing genocide is still happening during this month of Ramadan, even though obviously people that have been onto this issue since before October 7th will know that it's a regular occurrence that like they're suffering during this time of the year anyway. But that being said, I've never really thought about the fact that obviously you're fasting during it, but these people are like without food most of the time anyway.
There's a really, like, I remember like one of probably like a moment that really like radicalized me, like a video clip that really radicalized me when I was a lot younger, was, and it's quite famous on like the Muslim social media space, where there's during Ramadan, like they have these like late night talk shows where they have like sheikhs, like, you know, Islamic leaders and stuff, and then people will just call the sheikh and they'll ask questions and they'll have like Islamic discussions and stuff. And there was one person who called in and they oh my god, it's so heartbreaking. They asked the sheikh, like, if I don't have anything to open my fast with, does my fast still count? Oh my God, I literally, like, I remember just sobbing my eyes out watching that. And like, even now I get really emotional watching it. But we really take for granted. And that is also part of what Ramadan is. Excuse me. That is also part of what Ramadan is that awareness of, like, actually how, if we do have those, like, if we are lucky and privileged enough to have those provisions, to actually understand how lucky we are to have those provisions, you know? So sure. For all of us who are able to fast, like, in such comfort, obviously, as it is a time of, like, heightened prayer and heightened, like, kind of like God is, like, listening to you more, like, make sure you do keep, obviously, those less fortunate in your prayers. It sounds so cliche to say, but
oh, it needs to be said.
Yeah.
On the topic of things being less than fortunate.
Bad Vibes Island.
Ding.
And what a Bad Vibes Island.
Okay, I've been dying to talk about it for a hot minute.
Halima,
God.
Before you get very enigmatic, this new mic does not have a cover on it. So
is it? Am I bare loud?
You're very loud.
Am I bare loud? Sorry, I'm loud anyway. Sorry. Let me, like, lead back a little bit because I know I can't control my volume when I'm talking about this. You lot, I'm fuming. I'm thinking, I messaged Carlos, we need to get into it on radio. All week I'm thinking, let me get on that mic. Then I'm thinking, what can I possibly have to say that hasn't already been said? What is the... Guys, if you lot don't know, we're talking about Diane Abbott.
Do you want me to give the context and then you can...
Go on.
Yeah. Right. So, at the beginning of this week, I feel like it was maybe Monday, but anyway, towards the beginning of this week, for those who don't know, Frank Hester is one of, I think he's a billionaire.
He's the biggest Tory party donor.
Yeah, so he's the biggest donor. He's given over £10 million to the party over the past year. And comments that he made in 2019 have surfaced. I think it was The Guardian that broke it. And he reportedly said in 2019 in a private meeting, this is a quote, "It's like trying not to be racist, but you see Diane Abbott on the TV and you're just like, I hate. You just want to hate all black women because she's there. And I don't hate all black women at all, but I think she should be shot." Now, in a statement since this came out, he said that he accepts that he was rude about Diane Abbott in a private meeting, but his criticism had nothing to do with her gender nor the colour of skin.
Man said it makes you want to hate all black women. All now, it's not racist or sexist. This one, whatever reality, who's his dealer? Because I want to know. When Ramadan is finished, I want to know who this man's dealer is. I'm laughing because I got to laugh. Otherwise, I will go mental. I'll go crazy. Guys, what kind of nonsense country are we living in? Bad Vibes Island on steroids. It's actually ridiculous. Like, when you're break... Now, I don't even know where to start. I actually don't even know where to start. Firstly... This is, when we talk about, like, democratic politics, right? When we talk about Westminster, we're supposed to believe that it's impartial, that it's democratic, that that is completely, like, devoid of all biases. This is the largest Tory party donor, by the way, guys. Like, to say that this man has a pull in politics is an understatement. To act as though, like, this is a civilian making these comments, first and foremost, it's inaccurate. This is not a civilian. This is not an innocuous or a benign comment of someone's personal bias. This is someone who has a bias that will then be institutionalized because of their class position and the fact that they are the largest Tory party donor. That's first and foremost. Secondly, you know, one thing that strikes me is the flagrancy with which he says she needs to be shot. Man didn't just say, I hate her. He said she needs to be shot. And do you know what really, like, you know what that brought me back to?
Yeah.
Joe Cox.
Yeah.
Joe Cox. Because, like, we're not living in a world where you can make these statements and then, like, as I said, it's innocuous, where there's no, it's inconsequential. There's not going to be a consequence. We are living in... It is a demonstrated reality that a woman, a female politician from the Labour Party, just like Diane Abbott, has already been shot by far-right extremism. Yeah,
3 years before he...
Three years before these comments, yeah. Exactly. Like, this is not, like, a distant history... This is not like this is a far-fetched like reality. This might never happen. Like, this is a demonstrated. We all remember where we were when Joe Cox was killed. Like, I remember that story breaking. I remember the impact that it had on me. I remember thinking like, wow, this is like people's real lives that they are losing just because they're speaking out about X, Y, Z. To add to the fact now that Diane Abbott is a black woman that already makes her life a lot more precarious. In this situation,
I don't think we need to go into the background as to why that is. Like,
yeah, it's like, and this is it. Like we're not talking about like a personal distaste for her. We are talking about a hate and a rhetoric that is institutionalized. It is well documented how institutionally racist the UK is. And this is the bit that I really want people to understand. That's not just a freedom of speech. That's a call to action. That's a call to action. That's this man, right, who has insane influence over our current government, going out there and saying, this is how I feel about this group of people. It emboldens the British body politic, who also have those biases and who all have already demonstrated that they are not reluctant to pick up a gun and kill a woman.
Like, just to give a bit of background into Diane Abbott specifically as well, in a report investigating online hate received by UK women in politics prior to the 2017 general election, Amnesty International found that Diane Abbott received almost half of all the abusive tweets that they analysed.
Do you know how insane that rhetoric is? Yeah, I was also going to talk about this. The way Diane Abbott is treated in this country, in Westminster, is crazy. For those of you who aren't aware, she was the first black woman MP in the UK, in the country.
In history ever.
That is such a revered position to have. That is such a significant position to have. The impact that she's had on black women or like women of colour in at large cannot be understated. She really paved the way for so much for women of colour and for black women. The fact that she's receiving such, like, not even like, she's receiving like 10% of the share, 20% of the share, a whole half of online abuse. That's a whole 50%, one MP versus how many? 250 or something like that?
Yeah.
I swear we've got like...
It's like in the low hundreds.
Right? Yeah. Like that's it's insane. Like, that's actually insane. It really reveals the sick spirit of misogynoir that is very embedded into the fabric of like British life, politics and culture.
Yeah, and it's not even just the public as well. In 2022, the Ford report, and this was an independent investigation commissioned by Keir Starmer actually, into allegations of racism, sexism and bullying in the Labour Party, found that senior officials had shared messages about Abbott in their WhatsApp groups.
Oh my God.
Saying that she, quote, literally makes me sick and is, quote, truly repulsive. And the messages were expressions of visceral disgust, drawing, consciously or otherwise, on racist tropes, bearing little resemblance to criticisms of white male MPs elsewhere in the messages.
It's insane because it's like, what are you lot hating on her for? Like, what has the woman ever done? Like, if you look at her voting record, she is more upstanding than the vast majority of our MPs and politicians. But it's sorry. And do you know what like really annoyed me as well? And this really is the perfect anecdote of how black women in this country or in the West at large are treated. They had a Commons discussion,
PMQs, yeah.
Right, about this thing, and Diane Abbott stood up this whole discussion is about her. This woman stood up 46 times.
Yeah,
well, you lot, take a second, count to 46 right now. She stood up 46 times.
In 35 minutes.
Separately, 46 times this woman stood up to speak on a discussion about racism, about misogynoir that she is the victim of, and she was ignored.
Yeah, just to be completely clear, so the whole discussion wasn't about her. So PMQs
can be anything, but that particular topic.
But the point is that the speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, called upon both Keir Starmer and a member of SNP, Flynn, I believe. He called upon both of them and they raised the issue of Diana Abbott and the comments made against her. Yep. And it was discussed
that was
then.
That's what the topic at hand was.
Yeah.
And whilst this topic was at hand, Diana Abbott stood up 46 separate times and was ignored every single time. The way that... And this is a perfect anecdote, as I say, of just racism and misogynoir in this country. The way that it is made a subject matter, meanwhile, the actual victims of it are completely invisibilized and ignored and discarded, not centered, not given a voice. Like, it's literally the Britain's answer to racism, right? It's to make a massive song and dance about it, to have every... Why is Keir Starmer speaking?
Well, this is the thing. I've had so many people also... Rishi Sunak has obviously spoken about it and said that he's condemned the comments as racist and wrong.
But eventually he did. Yeah, he didn't at first.
But I think they've also, both Rishi and Keir, have both like been involved in discussions about whether Hester's apology should be accepted. And everyone's like, well, why are these two the ones
deciding?
Why are we not talking to Diane about, do you want to even listen to what Hester has to
say? And by the way, like, this man's apology, that man has not apologized for being racist.
Yeah.
His apology is that it was rude. My friend, rude is saying that you look like a gammon. That's what is rude. That's not what you said about Diana Abbott. That's not rude. That's racism. It's institutional racism, given your position. The fact that that is just like completely overlooked, and that the discussion now is like, oh, should we forgive him? The men who are not the victim of what was said.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm so incensed about this is because it's like, it's all right there in front of you. Like, it's not just that he made this comment. He made this comment amidst this, like, absolute kind of very, very long history of Diana Abbott being abused. Mm. When all she's trying to do is serve the people. It's just abhorrent. It's very, very abhorrent. It speaks to the absolute moral rot that is like deep within British society.
I think Lindsay Hoyle has since said that he ran out of time, but Diane Abbott's come back from that and said, like, well, actually, the PMQs can go on for as long as he wants. Yeah. And also, again, like we said, given the fact that they were literally discussing abuse that she's received, why would you not ask her to speak to her about it?
Even if it was like we had 3 minutes of time to speak on it, them 3 minutes should have been for her as soon as she stood up.
Yeah.
Like, it needs to be taken seriously. Like, for me, I think that's a death threat. I would take that as a death threat.
Well, this is the thing as well. It's all this thing about
She needs to be shot. Are you mental?
People are pointing out, obviously, in some of the Palestine protests towards the end of last year, the South Asian woman that was carrying a poster of Rishi and...
Oh, the coconut one.
Yeah, other South Asian MPs dangling as coconuts. She was investigated by the Metropolitan Police. To our, like, knowledge...
Calling someone a coconut,
To our knowledge, to this point, like, on the 16th of March, no investigation into these comments has been made.
Yep. Someone can be done for calling someone a coconut. This man has come out and said that a black woman who, as I say... It is well documented, the violence and the abuse that they face, the disproportionate rate at which they are killed by, whether it's like state neglect or like just active aggressors, is well documented in this country. The institutional racism, discrimination that they receive is well documented. To come out and say that this woman needs to be shot when there is a real contingency of those things happening, that's not just, that's not conversational to me. That's a threat. Like, that is, as I said before, this is the bit that people need to realize. It's a call to action. People now out there who already have those feelings are going to listen to that and be like, hey, I feel very emboldened. I'm going to go and do it.
If one, if one of the richest people in the UK can say that and get away with it and not face any repercussions, then...
He is the person who, outside of actual politics, has the largest influence on our government.
Yeah, it's the sitting government, isn't it? It's like
this is right now, control, you lot, the people that are governing you in this second as we speak. It's not, as I keep saying, it is not innocuous. You cannot just brush it off as it was rude or it was a private conversation. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, sorry guys, I think like a real, like, a real investigation needs to be done. Real consequences need to be had. This man needs to face like real repercussion. I don't think a man like that should be able to donate or like have a hand in like influencing party politics. I don't believe that. And the do you know what's such a kick in the teeth as well is like Diane Abbott, the treatment from the Labour Party of Diane Abbott. This is what annoys me of why Keir Starmer was even speaking in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, like they said to her, they'll return her whip if she agrees to not stand in the general election. You lot are that rattled by your own party members. It's mental. Oh my God.
For context, the reason why Diane Abbott doesn't currently have the whip taken away from her was because in April 2023, it came out that she'd made comments in which she said that Jewish, Irish, and traveller people do not experience racism, quote, all their lives. Which I don't think... I don't want to catch case. We won't go into that.
Yeah, we
right
will not
now.
Go into that. Right. But I mean, like, it is... One thing I will say about that, though, is that was a disproportionate punishment because there are, like, other politicians who have said way worse... And I've just, I mean, we made a prime minister out of a man that said Muslim women are letterboxes. Come on. Anyways.
Bad words.
Complete solidarity with Diane Abbott and any black woman like who have been like affected and impacted by, you know, the comments that have been made and the stories and the discussions that have been circulating. We are sorry that you guys have to put up with this. It is nonsense.
Yeah. At least Diane has seen, like, obviously the people of Hackney came together. I think it was last night on Friday. And showed their solidarity with her. But there's only so far that goes, you know what I mean?
Like, we need, like, real institutional intervention.
Yeah.
And this one, Frank Hester, put him in jail. Abolitionist, but jail!
Yeah, and I don't think I even need to say allegedly, because this person has literally said that a person should be shot.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, it's our opinion, but if you add up the facts, like... Anyway.
Yep.
Moving on. In other news in Bad Vibes Island, they have unveiled their new definition of extremism.
Goodness.
So...
What is it? Muslims?
Well...
He's a Muslim.
I believe the reason why this was triggered by was... Like, you know how Rishi came out and gave that last-minute speech about... It was when George Galloway got elected and he was, talking about far-right and Islamist extremism. Yeah. Anyway, so this new definition, which Gove revealed... again, it's so ironic, the fact that this was happening at the same time as all this other stuff with Diane Abbott, which basically... extremism is the promotion or advancement of an ideology based on violence, hatred, or intolerance that aims to, one, negate or destroy the fundamental rights and freedoms of others, or two, undermine, overturn, or replace the UK's system of liberal parliamentary democracy and democratic rights, or three, intentionally create a permissive environment for others to achieve the results in one and two. So he didn't stop there, though. What he did was he then went on and named specific organizations that may fall under this new definition of extremism. So he told MPs, organizations such as the Muslim Association of Britain, which is the British affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood, and other groups such as CAGE and MEND, give rise to concern for their Islamist orientation and beliefs. We will be holding these and other organisations...
Is that all he named?
Yes, so he named two others. So he was like, we will be holding these and other organizations to account to assess if they meet our definition of extremism and will take action as appropriate. I'm sure that we would agree that organizations such as the British National Socialist Movement and the Patriotic Alternative, who promote neo-Nazi ideology, argue for forced repatriation, a white ethno state, and the targeting of minority groups for intimidation are also precisely the type of groups about which we should be concerned and whose activities we will assess against a new definition. Now, I went away and like looked into each of these different groups.
Go on.
So, CAGE, for example, this is a organization whose ethos is to raise awareness of the plight of detainees held as part of the war on terror and to empower communities impacted by the war on terror.
My God.
Now, critics of it have said that it often acts for terrorism suspects, but it has never been accused of involvement in terrorism, and one of its founders has repeatedly won legal cases where they have been involved, accused of being involved in suspect groups. Now, MEND as well, that stands for Muslim Engagement and Development, and they aim to tackle Islamophobia and to encourage political, civic, and social engagement within British Muslim communities. On the flip side, the British National Socialist Movement, their ethos is neo-Nazism. The Patriotic Alternative, their ethos is racism, fascism, neo-Nazism, and white nationalism. Now,
one group of people just wants Islamophobia to end. Yeah. One group of people wants Muslims to die. My friend, how are they the same?
Yeah.
You know that meme? One of these things is not the same.
Yeah.
God, goodness. In the month of Ramadan as well, I thought Shaitan was locked up.
Yeah, the one thing that I can't comment on is, because I don't have too much knowledge on it, is the Muslim Association of Britain. they are, like I said, they've been alleged to be a UK affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood, but I'm not overly knowledgeable on that. But in response, they've said, if Gove is so confident in his views about the Muslim Association of Britain and other organisations alleging extremist views and a threat to UK society, we challenge him to state them outside of Parliament so that they can sue them. Because he can say that with parliamentary privilege, but he's saying, well, if you feel that way, come out and say it. And then,
that goes hard.
Yeah.
Take the cameras off.
Oh. Right, let me go and sort that out.
That's a really fantastic response. I back that. But also, like, that's actually crazy, like, the kind of false equivalences that they've drawn there, and they're just passing them off as though they're legit. Like, one group of people are literally neo-Nazis, have stated objectives of creating a white ethno state in Britain. Meanwhile, the other group of people, their name is literally Muslim Development. And that's who you're, Muslim Engagement and Development, and that's what you're calling terrorists. Also, like, was it CAGE, the one who bring awareness to the plight of detainees during
the war on terror. I think it started during Afghanistan, basically.
So if anyone, like, we probably don't have time to go into it now, but if anyone knows anything about the war of terror and, like, Guantanamo Bay, for example, and, like, just that entire kind of, like, politic and history, like, you will know how, like, the kind of global spike of in Islamophobia as, like, a globalized construct was really, really kind of engendered and ratified through this war on terror. To speak about the horrors that unleashed on the Muslim community all across the world is kind of like, I don't have enough hours in the day to do that. Now that someone is trying to bring kind of awareness to that is a very, very, like, worthy and worthwhile cause. It's very necessary. If we are going to undo any of the systems of Islamophobia, we do need to rework kind of where they came from and how falsified they were, which, by the way, is demonstrated. That's not my opinion. It has been demonstrated that so much of the excuses and the justifications that the Western governments were given, US and the UK were given during the war on terror, were falsified. And now that someone is trying to bring plight to that, they are being called, like, terrorist or terrorist adjacent.
Extremists.
Extremist is insane. But that's a label that they're always going to have, because what they're doing is they're essentially like exonerating people, right? So like obviously they're going to be like affiliated with extremists or accused terrorists or whatever.
It's like, also like, if you accept that what they're doing is right, and if that's right, then it implies that what the West did was wrong.
They don't want to do that. And I don't know. I feel like for me personally, as a Muslim, like I've lived with Islamophobia my whole life in the UK. I think, and this is just me personally speaking, I think, and like obviously I have to uphold all British laws, and I do. But I'm just saying, like, I have learned a long time to really, like, just not personally, like, respect or resonate with or agree with governmental definitions of what, like, hate crimes are or what free speech is or what extremism is, especially after Stansted 12. Like, and especially after, like, Shamima Begum and Stansted 12. And when all of that happened, like, I really took a long, hard look at myself and thought to myself, like, it can really be me. It can really be me. Like, when they said that those Stansted 12, they're getting done on terrorism charges because they tried to stop a flight from illegally deporting people, and they said, we're going to call you lot terrorists and we're going to put you up on terrorism charges, I thought, this country is done out. You could be doing anything anyhow, they'll call you a terrorist if you're the right skin tone.
Well, this is the thing. This is why I'm saying it's so ironic that we're having all these conversations about extremism and, like, alleging that organisations that are specifically designed to help those in the worst situations and also tackle Islamophobia and also get Islamic communities more involved in British politics. That's what these organisations are trying to do. We're calling them extremists. Meanwhile, the biggest donor for the Tory party is saying that he hates all black women, or he did say that he doesn't actually mean that. But he said that Diane Abbott should be shot.
Goodness.
Are we talking about extremism? Maybe we should start
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Like, start at your own party and the people who are donating to, who are keeping your party financially buoyant. Like, start there. It's just nonsense. Like, I can't engage with any good faith in this government, in governmental politics. That's the honest truth. Like, from, yeah.
You know what? Good on, like, people like Diana Abbott as well. The fact that, you know what, also, I didn't know she's 70. I thought she was younger.
She's been doing this. Like, she's dedicated her whole life to the British public, to British politics.
She
and that's how she's getting paid.
So much
resilience,
patience. Yeah,
so much grace. Yeah. I don't... That woman has more grace and patience in the end of her pinky than I do in my whole body. Man.
The fact that she still obviously continues to fight for what's right.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. See me, I would have cussed all of you lot out, took one flight to like Barbados or something, and you lot would have never seen me again. Are you mad?
It's true. Man. You don't need much pressure.
I don't need much to get me on a flight. True say, but... Yeah. Nah, she's honestly, like, she's been here. She's been fighting the good fight. Like, as I say, look at that woman's voting record and see if she's the one that deserves all the vitriol that she's getting.
Yeah. Well, like we say, we end on a negative note. Do you want to wrap a bit, lift the mood? Again, not during Ramadan, maybe not.
Maybe not during Ramadan.
But go on, Halima, say something positive to wrap it up. If you can, without coughing.
Oh, I do have something very positive. In 2 weeks, guys. In 2 weeks, the clock's gone forward.
Oh, yeah.
Yay! What is it, on the 29th? On the 29th, I think, or 28th or 29th? Exactly a fortnight, guys.
I think it's Saturday the 30th, yeah.
Is it? Guys, hold tight. One fortnight. We got one fortnight left, and the sun will be setting at 8 p.m. or 7 p.m. 8 p.m.
I don't know. But you know what's funny is that you're looking forward to that, whereas I actually prefer the other one because you get an extra hour sleep.
Girl, people like you make me sick to my stomach.
No, but I'm with you in the sense that I need it to be so... I'm so fed up.
Like, Do you think 1 hour of sleep is worth being depressed for 6 months, guys?
Fair enough.
It gets dark at 3 p.m. the next day. Oh, my God. I am so glad to be at the other end of it, guys. Like, we got 2 weeks. It's a home stretch, guys. It will be sunset at like 7, 8pm. Before we know it, inshallah, the weather will be getting warmer. God, you know what? I'm not going to lie. I actually don't mind the UK in the summer. Like, I really don't. London in the summer.
Can I have that in writing?
London in the summer, contender for best city in the world. I'm not going to lie. London in the summer is lit. I love it.
If you love it so much, why don't you love that? Actually, I'm not going to say
don't
that.
Don't say that, because you know I will. Because I will.
No,
I will.
No,
but London in the summer is a vibe.
Manchester, when it decides to be sunny.
Amazing. When you go out in town and everyone is out, all in Northern Quarter, they're all on the road.
This is what Simran always said, because she was obviously here for the week of my wedding, which thankfully was the week that it was really nice.
God bless you.
And there was one point like where we were out in town, and it was just the sun was shining, everyone was about, everyone was having a good time, and that was what made her be like, oh my gosh, I want to live here. Like,
I do love it. I love it.
She was sold a lie.
Yeah,
but when it does happen,
them 3 days a year when you're out in Northern Quarter and everyone is out on the road, or like, it's amazing. I love it. But inshallah, guys, we're gonna get that very, very soon. Yeah. I really hope. It is really my sins. Everyone, put your hands together. I'm going to say a prayer right now. God, dear God, please give us a really hot summer. Please give us weeks and weeks and months of sunshine. Please let us enjoy. Please let the spirit of enjoyment locate every single last one of us. Ameen. Because last summer was a joke.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like my wedding stole all of it.
It was very good. We had a great weather for your wedding. Yeah. And then we had like 2 months of rain every single July and August.
I hopped away to...
your honeymoon. Oh, yeah, you did. But
then the summer before, that was the one where it was ridiculously hot. You remember 2022 when it was literally like Dubai weather? Do you not remember?
Yeah. Oh my God, we had 40 degrees. I loved it. Oh my God.
Yeah, but that was also very bad. Like,
no, I loved it. I'm not gonna lie. No, because it was only like a few days where it was like extremely hot, but the rest of the time, like, it was just good weather.
I hope that we get consistently good weather that isn't too extreme and people.
What's extreme for you? What's your ideal temperature?
What, in the UK?
Yeah. Careful now.
I think anywhere between 27 to 30.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I could sign off on your summer.
I wouldn't want it to be that all year round, but that's like, if I had...
In the summer months?
If all summer it was sunny and that, I would be happy.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah. God, the way the depression will leave my body, it will fix me. I know it will fix me one good summer. Allah, please.
Right. We are going to play one song from Shehana, Focus On Me, and then when we come back, going to get into my interview with Waheed Iqbal, Ali Arshad and Hamza Medley, who are the cast and crew from Of God's Men. It is a film that is debuting at Manchester Film Festival a week today.
exciting.
Yeah, I was very lucky to be able to watch the film. Would definitely recommend. We'll say that there are some spoilers in the upcoming discussion, so if you do want to see the film before doing that, then keep us on, but just turn the volume down. But we'll be back soon with that.
Would you say
how rude of me, Helene? I forgot to say bye to you.
Bye, Carlos. Bye everyone. See you all next week.
Actually, no, you won't. Potentially.
Oh, yeah, potentially.
We won't go into this.
Inshallah, we won't see you guys next week. There's a reason why. But maybe the week after.
No, not even the week
not
after.
Not even the week after.
Maybe we might upload something to Spotify, but yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, see you guys. Love you, bye.
It's a very up end, man. Anyway.
You'll hear about it. You'll hear it. One way or another, you will hear about it. When you hear about it, is what's up in the air.
Yeah. This is a disclaimer from future me. If you would like to watch Of God's Men, I would suggest going and doing it and then listening to this interview, because there are a few spoilers in there. Yes, guys, what's good? You're tuned into Mango Masala, Pi Radio South Asian show. My name's Gerns, and I'm here with the director and leading cast of God's Men. So we've got Waheed, Ali, and Hamza here. How are you all doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
First of all, I know obviously we've had Hamza on the show before, but do each of you maybe want to just give us a little bit of background about yourself and what your role in regards to this film is?
I'm Waheed. I've been writing, directing films probably for the last 15, 20 years now. Of God's Men was second feature-length film. Finished directing in 2022, I think it was, and finished editing last year, and world premiering at Manchester Film Festival in a couple of weeks.
I'm Ali. I'm an actor from Manchester. I graduated in 2021, and Of God's Men was like my first ever feature film that I've been a part of.
I'm Hamza Medley, actor, musician, and like Ali, yeah, Of God's Men was my first feature film as a lead. Been acting since I was 16, and yeah, this came together beautifully. I'm happy to be here to chat to you.
Nice, definitely very happy to that all three of you are here taking the time to speak to me today, and thank you also for obviously giving me the privilege of being able to watch this as well before chatting to you, so it's really nice to be able to reflect on it properly and like discuss it with you today. Waheed, I'll come to you first. Obviously, you are the director behind this film. I was just interested if you could maybe give us just a little bit of a brief summary for people that don't know too much about it, and then also how the actual film came about, like what inspired it.
Yeah, I mean, the film itself, it's about a couple of brothers who are sort of like forced to live with each other, and both of them have just these very opposing views on life and the way they live. And the film is pretty much based around that conflict between the two brothers. That's kind of all it was. How would two people who have opposing views react when they're forced to sort of live with each other? But for me, ultimately, it was about making a film that I could relate to, in a sense. I find it very difficult to watch films where I can relate to the story and relate to the characters, because I never see, hardly ever see, stories and characters told from the community that, you know, I come from. So for me, it was a case of, you know what, if like, what kind of film do I want to see? What kind of film stories do I want to see on screen? Because I was kind of tired of everything that I have been watching. And it was just a case of getting that down on screen and showing something that could easily be taking place in my community. And that is mainly, you know, I come from a community of mainly South Asians, Pakistanis. Very rarely do you get people from these areas getting to tell their stories. I mean, even this, to be honest, no one wanted to offer any support for it. It's something that we all did off our own back, something that we all did for the love of the story. And it wasn't really a case of, where's this going to end up? It was just a case of, this is something we all want to be a part of because we all feel like we have something to say.
No, I'm really glad that you did stick with it and that the end product has obviously turned out really well. So Hamza and Ali, obviously you play Amin and Seth respectively. When it came to auditioning for roles, was it that you were auditioning for specific roles, or was it just an open call to be involved in the film? Like, how did it come about for you guys?
A mate sent it to me through Facebook, like an acting friend. I sent it for the role of Seth. The whole audition process was so like new to me, because we did like, I sent a self-tape, right? And then he got back to me saying like, I saw the self-tape, but do you want to like hop on Zoom and have a chat? And like, just that open conversation, like that's never happened before. Like you don't ever like send a self-tape and you get someone back from the director going, do you want to jump on Zoom and have a chat about it? Like, so just from the get-go, like that was so refreshing to see. And I think that helped as well so much, just to have that open conversation.
Pretty much the same as Ali. I think it was on Twitter, one of my friends saw her, she sent me. If I'm not mistaken, I had a few emails with Waheed here and there. One thing I do remember is that I in my head, when I was reading it, I was very much wanting to play the character that Ali's played, because I just felt I related to that one a lot more. I felt like it would be easier for me to do, but when I had the chat with Waheed over Zoom, it turned out that he was looking at me to play the role of Amin, which I found quite interesting. So I had to go back to square one and actually like read the whole script again. I think I've got the notes here somewhere, but I literally just wrote notes on the character, what I thought about him, what his journey was, random stuff that I thought would relate to it. And it turns out after that process, I actually related to him a lot more than I thought at the start.
I find it really interesting that you said that, because actually when I like was watching the film, when I'm first introduced to Amin, even in the first couple of scenes, I was like, wow, because obviously I've met and interviewed you before. I was like, this really seems like very much like a lot more arrogant and a lot more forward, like very like harsh type of character compared to the person that I've met and interviewed before. And I was like, okay, this is really interesting to see you in a different light. So it's interesting how you also saw that at first when reading the script as well. And I mean, it kind of takes me to my next question, which was, Obviously, you've kind of answered this already, Hamza, but like, in what ways do you to kind of see yourselves in your characters? Like, how much do you relate to them? And Wahid as well, actually, obviously, because you've come up with these characters, like, was there any kind of self-reflection in there, or was it purely drawing on acting or imagination when you were bringing these characters to life?
It was pretty much just how opposite can these two people who normally you'd look at, you know, a couple of brothers and you think they're very similar to each other. And there is some kind of like, you know, you can draw on it from some personal experiences. But it wasn't too much of that. It was more the themes. Each sort of character represented a theme to me. And in this day and age, it was almost like, you know, does that theme and does that character have a place in today's world almost? Like, you can look at them as more than just a character. You can look at one who is striving for, you know, a simple and religious life, whereas the other one wants all the worldly attention and what he can get in the here and now. And that kind of interested me. And it was like, how can I represent those themes as characters?
And also as well, watching it, it was interesting for me personally as well, because I grew up with two sisters, and in terms of my friendship group, I'm mostly friends with girls as well. So watching this brotherly relationship, from what I know, it seemed very portrayed very well. But it's weird, isn't it, that kind of brotherly relationship where even from the first time that they're meeting, after Surf has been in the hospital, at the beginning, their first instance is Amin just like pushing him around, that kind of like,
even that in itself, it's like there's a playfulness to it, but underlying, you know, there's just some tension there straight off the bat. You know, there's like opposing views here. They don't even need to speak to each other, and just that shove in itself, it kind of represents that conflict, and you know what's to come. And then they get in the car after that, and it's just instantly conflict straight away.
Yeah.
There's never really, very rarely, a nice moment between the two throughout the film.
That's kind of accurate as well, I think, for a lot of male-male relationships, I think, unfortunately.
No, you're right. And funny thing is, Sabrina, the only female who worked on the film, after she read the script, that was the first thing she pointed out. She was like, oh, this is what it's just male toxicity. That's that, you know, and it's kind of true in a sense. And I didn't really see that, funnily enough, until she pointed that out. And it's funny that you say that as well, man.
One thing that I found like quite good as well throughout the film was, although obviously covering quite a lot of serious topics, still managed to get those like funny moments in there as well. Like there was so many like little like gold nuggets throughout it that were just like, for example, the ones come to my mind is the where it means like popping his head around the corner when Seth is trying to pray, and it's just so childish, but I think it's very realistic in terms of that like brotherly relationship, of how they just do kind of just revert back to kids sort of thing, and that sense of immatureness never really goes away, even though these are two grown men.
And that genuinely comes down to the performances that these two guys, you know, put on the screen. If it wasn't for that, like, it could be there on paper, but if you don't get the actors who can pull that off, you know, and make things sound funny, it gives it a bit of, like, it humanizes it in a sense. Like, there's an element of seriousness. Sometimes you can look at something so serious and you just kind of can't help but laugh almost. And to me, that comes down to these two guys and the performances they put on the screen. I mean, you know what? These two guys, Hamza and Ali, you guys never met. Had never met before the film.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah, just through Instagram and stuff.
I think I knew of Ali, but never met in person.
You know, there's films where they'll get the lead actors to come in and build like a chemistry with each other. These two guys, the first time they met was first day on set, like an hour before the first scene was shot, and it just worked. It just worked, and there was a process behind that, like, you know, going through all the auditions and everything. And then obviously you get to the set and you just hope it's going to work. And it did, you know, it worked out. And anything like that you see in the film, whether, you know, you feel any kind of emotion you feel throughout the film, whether it's laughing or whether it's sad or angry. It's down to these two guys and their performances.
Definitely. One thing as well that you cover throughout the film, or is a recurring topic, is obviously Surf has been in hospital because he's tried to take his own life, which is the start of the movie, and I think we pick up like 6 months later afterwards. I think one thing that I really liked about the film as well was that it was a very key aspect of it, but it also didn't feel overdone. I do think sometimes films that focus on the topic of mental health kind of like narrow in and make it purely about this journey of self-discovery and getting well again, and it was nice to have a film that reflects on this and doesn't portray mental health in a negative light in terms of advocating for one's own mental health, but then it's realistic is what I'm saying. So Ali, also, what was it like for you, obviously knowing from the start that your character was going to have had these issues and you were going to have to portray them?
To be honest, that's what actually drew me to the film, because it was like exploring his mental health. Unfortunately, it's like a sort of taboo subject in our community and stuff. And it was just like how it didn't shy away from that subject, and how realistically it was handled. I related to it quite as well, because like I've struggled with my mental health, and like how this character is like, he internalizes his emotions, all of his emotions, like all of it's just bottled up inside. And that's what I do anyway. Like I really like, I don't ever like let anything out, do you know what I mean? Like any frustration or anger, do you know what I mean? And there's not like a moment throughout this film where he sort of gets that moment of like release, do you know what I mean? Like that moment, like you can just let it all out. It's always just so bottled up. Obviously, like he doesn't have a lot of lines either. So I felt drawn to the character from the get go.
And Amin as well also seems to have this sense of insecurity perhaps about Seth thinking that he's better than him almost, because he's so focused on praying. And I think there's also some conflict from before the film even starts as well. There's like a past there. Do you think there's a bit of both, in the sense that Seth does maybe think that he's does have that sense of high and mightiness maybe, but then also it's more Amin's insecurity as well? Do you think they're both at play there, or do you think it's more one or the other?
I think it's more insecurity than anything else. I think it's just complete insecurity. And one thing you need to remember as well, like these two brothers, obviously it's not highlighted in the film, but they obviously grew up together, and then there was a period of time where Amin left, and then they're seeing each other not only after he's come out of a mental health hospital or being sectioned or whatever, but there's years that they've missed between each other. So Amin has like this one way of understanding who his brother is, but obviously his brother's taken a different kind of path, and he's tried to process things in a different way, and that basically it triggers Amin, because it reminds him of his dad, basically, who you know, didn't have the greatest relationship with. There's a lot of insecurity there, because you've obviously watched the film. He's trying to run away. He's trying to get to another place, trying to buy a house and all this kind of stuff. If someone's secure in themselves, I think they'll be able to have those conversations. But I don't think there's a point in the film where he actually stops and says to his brother, "Yo, what's going on? Are you okay? Do you need anything?" It's more of a case like, "What are you doing?" Do you know what I mean? Yeah, he's a lost little boy. That's the way I see him.
Yeah, it's true. I think the closest we see to maybe him showing any kind of vulnerability is, I think, one of two. I think when he's admits like that the owner of the shoe shop, he's like, "I didn't, like, what, who was he to say that to you," sort of thing. That's what I was thinking. And then also obviously in Amin's final scene where he's actually like, "I'm not ready," and gives him the keys, and we'll get on to talking about that, but yeah, it was nice, even if it was just those little glimpses, to see that when he's like at a certain point, he can also like open up at least just a tiny bit. But talking about themes running throughout the film, I think one that I got specifically was this idea of balancing faith with family relationships. And I think we see that as well with the clips that Surf is watching like throughout on his phone. I think a few of them are kind of touching on this. And it got me thinking as well, because I think watching the film at first, I'm a lot more of a reserved character. So I think I found myself like siding with himself a lot more, because I was just like, why is Amin being so annoying? Just leave him alone, sort of thing. But then afterwards, I started thinking, especially in regards to this like theme that I picked up, and I was like, do you guys think that actually maybe both of them maybe could have tried a little bit more, rather than it just being Amin should have not been so hostile towards him?
Yeah, for sure. But I think if we were talking about, it's that lack of open like conversations, and won't ever like just sit down and have a conversation. Like, how many problems could have been avoided if they just sat down and said like, are you okay? Do you need to talk to someone? I think that's just relatable to guys in general. Like, we could be fighting demons in our head, but we never, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think with Ali's character, like you were saying before, is all bottled in. Whereas my character is the complete opposite end of the spectrum. He'll say what he's thinking, what he's feeling, for the most part, as long as it's antagonistic, I guess. But yeah, there is a balance that needs to be had. And I think the first part of finding that, whether you're on the introvert side or the extrovert side, is really just being honest with yourself and taking a minute to check yourself. Even just check yourself in with people that are going to have an opinion about you or towards you that you might not necessarily agree with. Sometimes it's humbling. Sometimes we're just a bit scared to get that humbling, to be able to grow as a person mentally, spiritually, whatever the case may be.
But I also find, though, as well, with especially with Amin, for me it was always a sense of like he almost sees some of himself in Saif as well, and maybe there's something there he sees in him that he can't ever sort of have himself, and that's where a bit of the animosity comes from as well. Sometimes we're our own worst enemy, and then we see something that's so similar to ourselves that we end up just despising it. When writing it as well, a lot of that animosity towards Saif's character from Amin comes from that as well, is the fact that he sees something in him that he kind of relates to as well, but he's too egotistical to actually admit that. So the only way he can deal with that is by showing, you know, this resentment almost to him.
And it's interesting as well, because I do think this lack of understanding and willingness to talk is actually what kind of sets off this domino effect that eventually leads to, unfortunately, spoiler alert for anyone that has yet to watch it, but Amin's demise as well, because essentially it's that disagreement, isn't it, at the shop where they both want to take breaks at the same time. They can't agree on that, so then they have to stay late. But then Amin leaves early, leaving Saif behind with the shoes. He then decides to obviously give the shoes away to a homeless person, which leads to them both getting sacked, which then leads to them both embarking on this life of crime, more Amin than Saif, but still, which then obviously eventually leads to Amin losing his life. So it is sad that obviously that could have all been possibly avoided if they'd actually talked to each other.
And I think the film also just highlights the kind of environments that some people are in, because for some people that is literally the line that they're balancing between, you know what I mean? Like, one wrong decision might not necessarily end their life, but it could damage their career prospects or whatever they want to pursue in their life, you know what I mean? And sometimes it's just a case of, if you don't have the right amount of privilege, you're struggling unless you make all the right moves at the right time.
I think you're definitely right in that sense of like privilege, because a lot of people in privileged positions, if they get fired from their job, they'd have like a bit of like a cushiony period where like, okay, fine, I've lost my job, but I can go and I can apply for others, I can rely on my parents, whatever. But obviously these two, at the end of the day, have only got each other. And then you see that Amin obviously is trying, he's going around to all these different places trying to get a job, and it's just not working out, which is why he then goes back to obviously that offer which he had at the beginning. And I think as well, the fact that obviously the offer at the beginning, it's obviously can't condone it still, but it's an empty gun. So although it's still robbery, at least he's not hurting anyone. And then by the end of it, I mean, I forgot about this point as well, is that obviously Saif chucks away the gun as well. And then that leads to, I mean, actually using a knife, which then leads to him getting stabbed. So it's all so interlinked, isn't it?
Yeah, like, but no, you're right though. It was everything just has a knock-on effect. Literally from the start, the moment that they meet each other, and you can just feel things, I don't know if you want to say escalating, but everything just carries on from one bit of one incident to the next. Even, you know, he steals, he finds the drugs in the car safe does, and then he hides them from his brother, and then his brother finds the drugs, and then and then it just builds and builds and builds until it's like, where else is this going to go? Like, how far is it going to go? And again, that just speaks about the characters never sort of like stopping and just saying, look, this is getting out of hand here. And in a way, that's like the biggest sort of connection between the two, is that neither of them ever stop each other and check on each other. And that for me was kind of like, in terms of similarities, like to personal life, I think that's probably the biggest thing for me personally, is that very rarely do family ever just check in on each other and be like, look, we need to just sit down and talk about this. And it was just a case of how far can it go? And obviously in this case, too far.
I wanted to ask as well about, besides the ending, I think one of the pivotal scenes in the film is the first robbery that Amin obviously commits, and Surfacer as well. We never actually see the robbery take place, but then in between Amin going in and coming back out to the car, there's that pause point, and we see pretty much every single character. There's that pause, and we kind of like see each of them just like looking into the camera sort of thing. I just wanted to know, like, what was the thinking behind putting that pause there rather than, say, later on where Amin loses his life sort of thing, which is arguably the one that I'd say that's probably the most important point of the film, because it's the demise of the lead character.
For me, that point onwards is the beginning of the end for me. That's where it actually starts going really downhill for both of them, because they're both in a position now where they don't know what they've done, and they don't know how to sort of move forward with it, and things can only get worse from here on in. And it's almost like they've bit off more than they can chew kind of thing, especially Amin's character, and Saif has just sort of been dragged into it. And you can see the demeanor of both of them, you know, they're hiding out. And it wasn't a huge robbery, but it was big enough for the two of them. Like, I'll touch on the reason why, you know, all the characters looking in the camera is because every interaction that they had with every one of those people, both of them, had led to that moment. And that moment there, that robbery, was probably the stupidest, the stupidest thing they could have done. Right. And it, like I said, it was the beginning of the end. Every interaction they had with them, with those characters, led to that moment. It wasn't just the interactions between the two of them. It was the interactions between all eight of them, nine of them. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes, you know, that's the reality of it. You may come across someone and it sets off, what's it called, the butterfly effect or whatever. You know, you might meet someone just for 2 seconds of the day, and something happens 5 hours later, and you're like, man, if I didn't bump into that person, this wouldn't have happened.
No, 100%. I definitely agree as well, although I think that the obviously it was from the point at which, I think it was like the break disagreement is maybe where things started going downhill. I agree in the sense that that is very much where things start to go drastically wrong. So yeah, it definitely makes
seriously wrong kind of thing. Everything up to that point could have been talked out. Everything after that point, it's like it becomes bigger than just a conversation.
Yeah, and I think the fact that obviously as part of that, Saif is in the car, and you can see that he's kind of thinking, like, I think he says as well, like, I'm not ready, like, this isn't what we need to do, but he's, like, not stopping Amin in his tracks.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, he just says, I'm not doing it. He doesn't say, I don't think you should do it as well. There's a different way. It's just, I'm not going to do it. And again, that just that little bit, it goes to show the sort of, like, almost selfishness of the two. Like, he's like, I'm not doing it, and Amin is like, well, I'm gonna do it anyway, and he goes out and does it.
It's interesting as well, because now I'm just remembering as well, obviously when they have that little brawl at home, Seth is actually able to overpower Amin, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. And now I'm thinking, because at first I was like, oh, but what can Seth really do? But then actually it's like, well, actually he can overpower Amin, so he could physically stop him if he really wants to. Like, yeah.
Of course he could. He could, you know, he could have just grabbed him yeah. and then just stopped him right there, but he doesn't. But he has the ability to, but he yeah. doesn't. And again, it's just, it purely is just one track mind characters who aren't sort of deviating from what they believe, even for the sake of each other.
One other theme or reoccurring thing throughout the film is this number plate as well, that obviously we see Amin's trying to sell it at the start, and then around halfway through Seif actually finds it in like the trash sort of thing, and I gather that this was a private number plate that used to belong to the two's dad, and then it's actually the reason why Seif comes back towards the end of the film. So I was wondering, like, what was the, was there some kind of like symbolism behind that, or is this just, is it maybe like the one thing that's kind of actually drawing them back to each other? Like, what was the reason for including that?
The only thing it symbolizes was their father and the two's relationship with their father. Obviously the father's not there, but there had to be some kind of presence from the father. And if you look at the number plate, is just a number plate. It could have been anything. But if you look at the way the two of them kind of had a deal with the number plate, it's almost like an extension of their relationship with the father. Like, Amin's always trying to get rid of it. And then he said that towards the end as well, there's a line, like, he says, the arrogance, we both know where you got that from. And he says, well, if I got that, what did you get? And he's like, well, nothing. That's what happens when you didn't get to know your father. And that's what it was. The number plate was just an extension of their relationships with their father. One comes back for his father because obviously he probably had a better relationship, and the other one was trying to get rid of the number plate because that's something that he didn't want a part of.
Amin's dream is to obviously be able to buy this house eventually, and kind of like have his own little escapism kind of thing. Whereas Seif's dream is purely, and it's actually as well, because you can see in his therapy sessions, the one thing that he, like, his reason to live essentially is his faith, and therefore he's kind of putting everything into this idea of renovating the local mosque. It's interesting as well because you see that both of them, although arguably Amin's dream is maybe a bit more materialistic in the sense that he wants this house for himself, whereas Seif's dream is obviously a mosque for everyone to use, but both of them are getting money from it in nefarious ways. So I think it's interesting to see, like, it raises this kind of question as well of, like, is it okay to put money towards things or like get things through bad means if it's for the greater good sort of thing. That was one thing that got me thinking, especially the shoe scene, obviously, as well, where, because I was when he stole the shoes, I was fully expecting him to go and like sell them and then use it to put towards the mosque. But then we went and handed it to the homeless person. I was like, wow, like, he really is, like, this is a proper like philosophical conundrum in my head now. Like, is this actually okay or not?
It's no different than Amin's character selling drugs to, you know, achieve his goal. To me, that was the biggest similarity. Like, in a sense, they both had the same goal. They both had the exact same goal. One wanted this big house and to get away from everything. The other one was building a mosque, and he was building something for the hereafter. They were both doing what they needed for pretty much the same goal. And both of them, in a sense, this was our motto throughout the film, was by hook or by crook, they both were just like, we're gonna do this no matter what it takes kind of thing. Even if it means like stealing, or if it means getting money that's, you know, from a dubious sort of like means, and giving it to the greater good kind of thing.
There's one scene where, you know, that fighting scene, we did that on, like, I think it was like the hottest day of the year, and we were in this flat, absolutely roasting there for like, what, 10, 12 hours or something like that. It was the longest day of my life. But yeah, man, like, I think obviously when you watch the film, you have your own inference from it because you've not seen what's gone into it. But I think when we did the cast and crew show in, like, obviously I was watching the film for what it was, but at the same time I'm just seeing all these moments that we had together, and it was just a really good time.
It was the hottest summer we'd ever had, hottest summer in the UK, and the peak of that summer, those 2 weeks, was when we decided to film, and which worked out perfectly, actually, because it didn't mess with the schedule. There was no rain or anything, and we were able to get through these 2 weeks with no hiccups, which is crazy for a micro budget independent film. Nothing kind of went wrong, but it was just, he's right, I just remember being in that small room, Amin's bedroom, and it was the tiniest room. It was like a shoebox, and there was everyone was in there. There was about 8 of us in there, and we weren't allowed to open the windows because audio reasons. And I just remember looking around at everyone, and I remember looking at Dan. He was a sag, and he had this big bead of sweat just dripping down his head. And I just remember thinking, this is crazy. And no one was complaining. And I just remember thinking, this is what I'm going to remember from this film in 10, 20, 30 years time, that we were all just here. No one was complaining. Everyone was just doing what they're doing. Hottest day of the year. Ali always had to wear his big duffel coat, same with Hamza, that big leather jacket. And I used to say to him, you know what, guys, you're going to miss this as much as you hate it. You're going to miss it. But those are the moments, you're right, those little moments, that's what you think back on, and that's what you miss.
I mean, it's funny, you kind of have answered what I was going to ask, actually, which was, is there a particular scene that stands out to each of you in terms of whether it was particularly funny or favourite or challenging to film? So besides, obviously, the fight scene and the really hot scene that you've just talked about now, is there any other ones that stand out in particular to you?
Well, for me, it's it's that slap scene. Just when he gets absolutely leathered. But just because on the day when we were shooting it, right, I think I was I think where he could see, I was anticipating the slap. I knew it was coming. So then he took he took Hamza out for a minute to just have a chat. And he came back in, we ran the scene again. And Hamza just starts pacing up and down and stuff. That's not in the script at all. So I'm just thinking, when's it coming, Johnny? And I just, out of nowhere, I just feel like my cheek gets all swollen and red. And I was just in shock for a good minute. Just, I was too afraid to move.
It was funny because Ali was how do you want me to react? And after the slap, and I was just do what you got to do, Ali. I don't care. Just react. And then Hamza lays this massive slap on him, sent him into the last week. And then Ali just froze, and then everyone was just waiting for him to do something. And it was don't cut, just stick with it. And he's just there for 30 seconds, just looking off into space. I was how hard did Hamza slap him? But we didn't cut. And then that's in the film. He just he just freezes, and he's just there. And it just worked perfectly, though. It just worked perfectly. That was a good scene.
From my aspect, how I remember that scene was, Ali didn't give you the full picture because we did about 10, 11, 12 takes of that. We were literally, first Waheed was said, so just do the pacing. And just before I'm about to slap this guy, Waheed said, cut. And I was okay. Second time, third time, fourth time. About the fifth, sixth, seventh time, I'm starting to get annoyed now. I'm am I doing something wrong? What the hell's going on? And the second to last time, or maybe two or three times before I actually did it, he called me out and he goes, I'm just trying to psych Ali up. Don't worry. You'll know when to do it. It'll be this one or the next one or whatever. And eventually we got to it. But at the time, I didn't realize it. Obviously, he's just trying to psych him out. But it psyched me out as well, because I actually wanted to slap him by the end of that. Do you know what I mean? Because I was just getting so frustrated. But
when it slapped me, I think.
Yeah, but
You know what? Seriously, these two are put through their paces, man. I can look back on it sometimes. I think maybe I was a bit too tough on them.
No, I don't think so.
But at the same time, I always said to him, make the most of it, because very rarely, from here on in, hopefully, it's just going to be you're working your way up, and very rarely you're going to have these interactions with a director. So it's just make the most of it. But I did put them through their paces. I'm not going to lie. Even the drowning scene with Ali, that was actually shot on the last day of shooting. So you can imagine, like, we've just literally been through like 15 days straight of filming, and then the last, you know, Ali's last scene that he has to film is him lying in the bathtub, you know, underwater, and that wasn't easy. Ali can tell you that. Whenever anyone watches the film, the first thing they comment on is like the performances, the actors. And for me, like, yeah, if that's all anyone sees in that film is how good these performances are, then I'm happy, because these guys earned it, man, definitely.
It was really cool to watch it as well, like, for multiple reasons. What, one being just because I'm not really like a film person myself anyway. Like, I rarely have the patience to like sit through a film. So if I'm being completely honest, when I saw this and I saw it as in like an hour 48, I was like, oh, okay, this is like proper, like, because I think as well, like, when it was like, oh, you're in a feature-length film and it's at a film festival, I was like, oh, okay, cool, probably like an hour or something. And then it was nearly 2 hours long. I was like, okay, this is like proper, like, getting into this. And I think you can really tell that it was done a good job of, I think, by the fact that I was very much invested in it and I wanted to, like, watch the end. I wanted to know what was happening. And the ending as well, like, took me a bit by surprise. I don't know why, like, I didn't see that that was going to happen, but I think I thought maybe that Amin would end up going to jail or something. I didn't realise, okay, wow, he's actually going to lose his life at the end of this. But yeah, definitely, like, I think good performances from everyone, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what the general public think of it as well. So obviously it's being shown at Manchester Film Festival, right?
Yes, yeah, 23rd of March, 1 o'clock.
Great Northern.
There's tickets available as well, so... yeah, if just go on the Manchester Film Festival website and you can purchase tickets. They're selling out pretty fast, actually. So if you're going to get them, now's your chance.
Definitely, would definitely advocate going and seeing this film. And I think the thing, again, another thing that I really like about it as well is, although obviously it's got these themes that revolve around, it's obviously two young South Asian men who come from the Islamic faith, it's not exclusionary in any sense. You don't have to be from that background yourself to actually watch this film. Like, it's very much like you can watch and enjoy it and take from it no matter what your background is. So
yeah, absolutely. And again, credit goes to these guys for that, you know.
Credit
that
goes to the creator. He's too humble, man. Credit goes to
but like, it's like a case of anyone can relate to the characters, right?
Just the well-written, bro.
But you guys perform. No one cares about what goes on behind the camera.
No, like, we do. Well.
Everyone relates to what they see on screen. And you're right. It is a case of, it's not just for a South Asian demographic. It's like anyone could turn up, anyone could watch this, find something that they relate to.
So if beyond the film or following the success of the film, people want to keep up to date with all of yours work, where's the best place for them to find you?
Probably Instagram, to be fair. AL1AR5HAD.
I'm a bit on LinkedIn. Like, there's nothing you'll find on me online much, so.
You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Hamza Medley, HAMZAMEDLEY.
Sweet. And I suppose for Waheed, we'll just keep an eye out for the next projects coming out from you then.
Yeah, soon, hopefully soon. There's a lot of things in the works, so.
How do you two feel about going to the festival? Like, how do you feel? Are you nervous? I'm nervous as anything, man.
I'm buzzing, man. I just can't wait to see everyone, like the crew and everyone that just like see yeah. The vibes. Yeah, I'm buzzing.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna have to be there to actually, like, you know, for it to hit me. But I'm excited, definitely. It's gonna be fun. And enjoy it. You guys should enjoy it, man. Like, two guys from Manchester, first ever feature length film lead characters, and you got a film that's world premiering in your own hometown. Like, when is that going to happen again, man? I'm sure it will, but like, just make the most of it. Seriously, just make the most of it. Enjoy it. You guys earned it.
Thank you so much to the three of you for taking the time to speak to me today. It's been a pleasure. And for anyone that is interested from the discussion we've had today, hopefully there haven't been too many spoilers. Hopefully the public enjoys it as much as I do. So thanks to three of you.
Yeah, thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for watching.